From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. On today's show, challenging times for America's labor unions.
The crisis that labor faces today is real. It's one of the most difficult moments in labor's history.
We'll get an inside look at what it's like to be homeless in northern Michigan.
It just basically was a cavalcade of things that happened that I had absolutely no control over.
How one man managed to get his life back on track. Plus, why it's important to preserve the old news stories of a community.
It really is a key to unlocking not just local, but personal history.
And Detroit is teetering on the brink of financial disaster again. What does that mean for the rest of Michigan? Those stories and much more today on Stateside. But first, the news. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It's been a week now since voters in Michigan turned down Proposal 2, the ballot question that would have guaranteed collective bargaining rights in the state constitution. On today's show, we take a look at America's changing attitudes toward labor unions and just what it means for the nation's economic future. But first, in other economic news, the board overseeing Detroit's wobbling finances is getting some dire warnings about the city's cash flow situation. Detroit's program management director, William Andrews, told the advisory board the struggling city is on the financial brink yet again. Let's turn to Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes to get an understanding of what this all really means. Daniel, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well, it seems to be a real familiar refrain. Detroit is running out of money. So how soon do they say this could all happen?
It could happen as early as next month. Some chips have to fall in a certain way. What's hanging out there right now is about $80 million in bond proceeds that the state treasurer's office is holding pending some more and additional reforms with the city. I think there's some hope that they can persuade council and to come to an agreement and to move ahead with some of these reforms, which would release somewhere in the order of $30 million by the end of the year, which would help them kind of kick the can further down the road. But I do think that it's really important to note here that time is really running out here for the city. And with the emergency manager law now repealed, you have a weaker one that comes in its place.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially, the mayor's office and the treasurer have lost the hammer that they had, which was the emergency manager who had the power to abrogate union contracts, which is probably one of the strongest levers, which is why people push to get rid of it. But that's kind of what we're faced with, which really brings us back to a much greater possibility of Chapter 9 bankruptcy.
I want to get into what the reforms are. What would it take to get State Treasurer Andy Dillon to open up the purse strings and release that escrow money?
Well, one of them is a set of contracts that need to be renewed and approved. One is with I think it's Ernst & Young, which is for financial analysis that they need to move forward with their restructuring. The other is with a law firm, Miller Canfield, a prominent Detroit law firm. But there are members of the city council who have concerns with that, and as a result are raising questions, which is kind of par for the course with the Detroit City Council. There's always a demand for more detail, who's going to get what, and it's a continual process. And meanwhile, they just keep burning cash. And I think that's the thing that your listeners need to understand here. Any city or company, frankly, that is operating in a deteriorating cash position, as long as they're paying people, as long as they're paying their vendors, albeit on a longer time schedule, they're burning cash.
Mm-hmm.
The revenue intake from the city, I think if my memory serves, is about $18 million short in the last collection of tax revenue. So they're not getting the revenue they thought they were going to get, and they continue to burn through cash, and some of their healthcare spend on health care for employees and retirees was actually higher than they expected. It's pretty obvious to people, I think, what that means. That means that things get worse faster, and that's essentially what they're facing.
Daniel, the relationship between Mayor Dave Bing and Detroit City Council just seems to be totally at loggerheads at all times.
Yeah, I've been very critical of this, and particularly insofar as the mayor is concerned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he really has got, I think if you look at the city council, I've been familiar with Detroit City Council in some ways, depending on which jobs I've had at the paper, close to 20 years. And this is clearly the most competent and the brightest council that I've seen. And clearly there's a majority on council of 5 members that could be a natural majority for the mayor if he worked with them to build political relationships. But he sees several of them as potential, or has seen them as potential rivals for another term as mayor. And therefore, I think he and his people continually downplay their credibility and question their credibility and their bona fides as to what they bring to the table. The net is, I think the mayor has shown a pretty appalling inability to build political alliances. And he's been very open about his disdain. He's been open to me. He said it to me. He said it to me in public places where other people could hear him. I don't think there's any question that the members of council know how the mayor feels about him. And now when he needs them, I think it's a much harder, it's a much heavier lift for him. They also, that said, they know they're in a very tough spot. But I think they're the pace at which they're doing things shows that they really don't appreciate how serious the situation is in its fullness. When all of a sudden an entity starts to trip wires, if you will, by missing payments, missing payrolls, that has massive implications with their bondholders, and who can start to call the bonds and everything because they've missed these gates, and that becomes a very, very serious predicament. And the financial people, whether they're on the financial advisory board, whether they're in the state treasurer's office, whether they're the governor, I mean, you have a very financially astute governor right now. They understand the score and they know what's going on here with great clarity. But there really is a search now for Plan B, and I don't think it's readily apparent yet what it's going to be.
Well, I know William Andrews says the city needs to find new revenue sources. In your opinion, how likely is that to happen?
Well, I think one of the ways he's probably talking about is the revenue that can be released, but with reform. Whether it's reforming payroll systems, or there's a whole bunch of different systemic things that the state wants the city to do. And that, by the way, would release, I think, another chunk of money if they got some more progress on some of that stuff. That's a way, by reforming it, essentially they can free more revenue to pay the bills. But they have to do it with dispatch. And I think the problem here is you have an old Detroit bureaucracy that is not used to moving quickly. In fact, it probably isn't capable of moving very quickly and is very resistant to somebody pushing them from the outside saying, you need to do this, and you need to do this like by the end of the week. That type of thing, I think, make things very difficult. The other thing we need to make right here is that their lawyer, the Corporation Counsel, Crystal Crittenden?
Yes,
I think there's quite a fear that based upon what she did in some earlier challenges to the emergency manager law and other things, that she will come back and create more roadblocks. I also think there's a feeling, and I heard it over the weekend in some conversations I had with some high-ranking officials at the city, that both the unions and potentially Crittenden are going to be filing a bunch of lawsuits to try and claw back some of the cuts that were made under the aegis of the emergency manager law.
Yes.
And therefore they lose the savings and they lose the time. I think reality needs to set in here at some point and say you cannot kick the can proverbially down the road indefinitely and think that something's not going to change.
But let me just ask, on the behalf of perhaps someone who's listening, who's on the west side of the state, and says, so what? What does it mean to the rest of Michigan to have this happen? So what? They can't get their house together. Let the chips fall where they lie.
And you know what? I absolutely get that. I respect that. And I mean that in all sincerity.
Mm-hmm.
That said, there are real implications, I think, for the city, for neighboring communities, including Oakland County, which, by the way, has got one of the highest rated, one of the most stellar credit ratings of any county in the United States, despite what it's gone through the last few years. I think the cost of borrowing for neighboring communities becomes more expensive.
Hmm.
Cost of borrowing for the state becomes more expensive. Relatively speaking, is it something the state of Michigan can handle? Probably. But think about the PR and image hit that not only the city takes, but the state takes. You now will be home. I was thinking about this as I was writing my column for this morning. You now will be the only place, probably the only, I think the only place in the United States where your signature bellwether industry has gone through a very highly publicized bankruptcy, bailout by the federal government, and then the city itself becomes the largest municipal entity in the history of the country ever to go through bankruptcy. I mean, if that doesn't have failure written all over it, I don't know what does.
And the next advisory board meeting isn't even until December 10th, which shocked
right.
me when I read that. Wouldn't you think there would be a sense of, you know, DEFCON 9?
Yes, but I think the heavy lifting is being done behind the scenes. It's being done by the mayor's administration, his project manager, and people from the Treasury Department. The mayor and the governor are supposed to meet this week to start to hash this through and say, you know, what is Plan B? What are some of the bridging mechanisms that we can have here? I think one of the real concerns and I think a likely possibility here is they try to paper this thing over and kick it down the road to the next election in 2013. I mean, that's a year away, but you have the possibility that the mayor may not run for re-election, because I think a lot of people feel that if he ran for re-election, he couldn't get re-elected. And you have a new council that would come in, and they would be representing districts. So for the first time since, I think, 1918, a Detroit City Council would be comprised of members who actually represent geographic districts within the city. I mean, currently, and I think a lot of people may not appreciate this, the entire city council could live in one apartment building.
Right.
That said, Rick Snyder is not the kind of governor, and I think has shown in the first 2 years that he does not want to paper over problems and keep pushing them and kicking them forward. And I think if the emergency manager law would have stood up, there was a very distinct possibility that before Christmas he would have named an emergency manager for the city.
Now he can't.
If he does, it's under Public Act 72, and that person does not have the power to abrogate union contracts or to override the will of the elected officials.
Daniel House, always good to talk with you. Thanks for talking with us today on Stateside.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Still to come, the small-town newspaper lives on. We'll meet a man who says preserving a town's old news stories is important for everyone. That story in 10 minutes on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Yesterday on the show, we talked about a poverty simulation that's being held tonight at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor. It's an effort to get people with homes and incomes to understand the challenges faced by those who don't. We continue with that theme today. When you see a homeless person, what kinds of assumptions come to mind? Chances are you might not see that person as someone who, say, served in the military for many years, someone who holds a master's degree, someone like my next guest, Greg Nelson, who, despite having served in the Coast Guard for a decade and having earned a master's in engineering from the University of Oregon, ended up living on the streets. Today, Greg has a home. He's gotten his life back on track, and he helps others get their lives back on track. Greg Nelson joins us now from Gaylord. Welcome, Greg.
Thank you, Cindy. How are you today?
Doing well. Greg, start by giving us kind of a sense of when and how did you become homeless?
Well, my journey into homelessness started in 2004. I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. And over the next couple of years, it progressed to the point where I wasn't able to work anymore. And one thing fell behind another, just like dominoes. My work, I wasn't able to work. I wasn't able to have insurance. I had to pay medical bills myself. I lost my home. I ended up homeless and for a while living in a travel trailer out on a farm, going through chemotherapy and trying to stay alive. It just basically was a cavalcade of things that happened that I had absolutely no control over.
So this cascade of events, starting with the cancer diagnosis and you're being too ill to work.
Correct.
Which brings home something that I've always had a sense that if we were all really, really honest, most of us are just a few paychecks away from calamity, aren't we?
We are. You know, and I had done everything I that you were supposed to. I put money into a retirement account and everything. But that lasted, 6 months.
Mm.
With all the huge bills I was having to incur.
So how did this cycle, this downward spiral, how did it reverse and you found yourself where you are today?
I have to say it's been April 24th of 2010 was my last chemo. Getting myself stable was a big thing, and I have to tell you the VA is instrumental in my life and just every facet of it. Getting involved in programs, I tell you, probably the biggest thing that I had to overcome was not feeling shame and getting over the pride of asking for help. Once I did do that, there are programs out there for non-veterans and veterans alike that they're remarkable.
There must be a real internal wrestling match to come to the point to be humble enough to say, you know what, nothing's working, I do need help. Did you fight that for quite a while?
Cindy, I fought it for several years, I had many people come to me to offer me help even. You know, I mean, it becomes an internal thing where you have to deal with that. You feel that you have to deal with the shame that you have not been able to, in society's eyes, been able to take care of yourself or take care of your situations or plan or do all the things that we're taught to do. And it was a very big struggle for me.
So once you accepted help, and you say that the VA really has saved your life, how so?
Well, I tell you, I came from Oregon. It's been 2 years ago, November 4th. I have some friends that live here. I came to the, they offered me a place to stay.
Mm-hmm.
I had basically wore out my welcome where I was before. So I came to Michigan. They offered me a place to stay, and it just turned out to be disastrous, actually. I lived there for basically about 7 months, and it came to the point where there was verbal and physical abuse happening. Mm-hmm. And, I had gone through heart surgery, I'm in a wheelchair now. So, you know, my last resort I had was to call the VA. And the very next day that I called them, they were there, and they packed up my clothes and put gas in my truck and took me to the Friendship Shelter in Gaylord here. And from there on, you know, my life was, it was on the way back. You know, it really was. When they told me he was going to take me to a shelter, I just thought to myself, oh, my God, you know, all I could think of was a place where there was, for lack of better terms, a bunch of drug addicts and alcoholics and bums, people who didn't care. And, you know, when I got there, I found people that were enlightening. And, I became social again and was able to see that I wasn't alone and I wasn't unique in this situation.
And isn't that interesting that even as you were caught in this journey into homelessness, you still had those attitudes that I think most people have when they think of shelters and the homeless, didn't you?
I did. Well, you know, and I thought of this place that was a terrible, nasty place, you know. It's kind of like the dark side.
Yeah.
It wasn't that at all. The people were so incredible that were there to help us and help, you know. I will be indebted to all these people for the rest of my life.
So, Greg, tell us about your life today. Now, you're in remission, so you're done your chemo. I heard you say, woohoo, April 24th, 2010. I know that's a big day when anyone finishes their chemo.
Oh, it's been a big deal. It was a battle for 6 years.
Yes.
And, you know, I actually finally, after almost 3 years of battling, I finally received my Social Security disability. And I am living in a place. It's called Alpine House here in Gaylord. It's just an incredible place, brand new, and it is for disabled and senior citizens. It's HUD is funded apartment complex. My life over the last year has been so incredible, and every day gets better and better now. And all I can do is try to help everybody that has been in the situation that I have. For the first time in June of this year, for the first time in 6 years, I didn't receive food stamps. that was a milestone. I'm sorry, I get a little emotional talking about this stuff. I'm able to come and go and do what I need to do. And my biggest thing that I can do now is I go out to the homeless shelter once a week and I volunteer out there. I work with a social worker and we put on an employment workshop every Wednesday for 2 hours. And I try to work with the veterans as much as I can.
But you have found in your experience, haven't you, that lines are long, aren't they? Waiting lists are long to get into shelters. Is it hard to navigate the system?
The system isn't equipped to handle the extent of what's happening out there. It's become a hidden and almost a secret society. I have seen firsthand caseworkers tromping through the woods in 2 feet of snow to get people to come into shelters that are living in tents, people just don't see it, the people that are homeless don't want people to know it. And so they withdraw from society as much as they can. But the problem is it's very extensive.
Greg Nelson, thank you for sharing your story with us. And we wish you continued recovery and good health and good fortune.
Well, thanks, Cindy. I appreciate it. I hope that people can see what's happening out there and step up to the plate.
Thank you, Greg. In this era of instant access to news via TV, internet, Twitter, Facebook, served up anytime and anywhere and anyhow we want, it's hard to remember there was once a time when people pounced on their local newspaper to learn what was happening from their local city hall to Washington and around the world. Just think for a moment about all of the stories that were told through the years on the pages of those local hometown newspapers. Eli Nyberger thinks these are stories that need to be preserved, even if the newspaper that published them has fallen by the wayside. He's with the Ann Arbor District Library working on a project called Old News. Eli, explain this. Just what is Old News?
Well, Old News is our online archive of previously published news and newsletters, mostly from Washtenaw County. It began with the closing of the Ann Arbor News when we were able to negotiate taking possession of their whole physical archive of photos and clippings and bound volumes. And our goal is to get as much of that information online as possible and get people the answers to their questions about their own history.
So how are you doing that? Is it scanning? Is it a lot of work, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. But it's mostly scanning. And then a lot of the work is also adding what librarians call metadata, which is information about information, like who was mentioned in the story, what article, what topics is the story about, including words that might not actually appear in the story itself. And also helping people find answers to their questions, because it's such a big collection, rather than starting at A and trying to go through Z, we're driving the digitization by the questions that we get. So people will contact us and tell us what they're looking for, and we'll find those articles, not just send them only to them, but publish them on the web for the whole world.
So what kind of questions are you getting asked?
We're getting all kinds of wonderful questions. Of course, with newspapers, a big interest is always obituaries when people are doing genealogical research. So we had one lady who was trying to find out the truth of a family legend about how a great-grandmother had died. And through the news articles that we had in our collection, we were able to find the truth of the matter and what had actually happened, and also help the woman to find the gravesite, which had not been known. And through that, she discovered what happened to several other family members from that period. So it really is a key to unlocking not just local but personal history.
And there you are as a library, a resource for the community. And I dare say many of us would be surprised that someone was able to find out all that information by turning to her library.
Well, I think that there was always sort of this perception that it's buried in there somewhere. But a lot of people don't understand that libraries are service organizations and that we want to help people find what they're looking for. And often all there is to find this sort of thing is to ask. And our goal in this case is to have as much of it be findable as possible so that people who don't even know what they're looking for can get into a conversation with us and help us find the true stories that are going on back there.
So what is the time span that that these archive of stories runs from?
Well, some of our earliest stories are actually from the Signal of Liberty, which was an abolitionist paper that published in Ann Arbor in the 1840s. And it goes all the way up through when the Ann Arbor News closed in 2008. So there's a very wide range in there.
What are some of the favorite stories that you've uncovered or that you, eras that you've kind of dipped into as you've gone through these?
Well, we had a couple different interesting ones over the past year or so. One was, of course, there were questions about UFO sightings in Ann Arbor in 1966.
I totally remember that.
So we had all the articles about it, but we also did an audio interview, a podcast with Sheriff Doug Harvey, who was the sheriff at the time, who told us his experiences of the man from Washington showing up. And you can find that on the feature on our website here. Doug Harvey talk about his experience as sheriff. Another thing that we recently had were some questions about G.G. Allen's famous bender at the halfway house at East Quad here in Ann Arbor.
Now,
he was a punk musician.
Okay.
And basically kind of crossed his final straw here in Ann Arbor and wound up in a mental institution and all. So that was an interesting story to uncover.
I would say so.
And most recent, a little over a year ago, we had a question from a sci-fi channel producer. They have a show called School Spirits about ghosts on college campuses, and they were determined to find a story about a ghost somewhere on the University of Michigan campus. And we looked really hard, and it's interesting to see how the story came together in their finished piece.
A little different than perhaps you might have expected.
Yes, lots of lots of screaming co-eds, and there was none of that in the paper.
All right, needle in a haystack, I would suspect. I call you and say, what can you tell me about ghosts on the University of Michigan campus? Do you physically just start flipping through these pages? What's the process?
Well, there's a number of different files that we have to look through. There are some topical files that librarians at the News had maintained for years. So in some cases, we have that as a starting point. But in many cases, if we can get a rough date, we can start paging through the bound volumes, the papers themselves, and see what's in there. However, there's also a lot of name files, people by name. And one of our earliest goals was the project was to take all of the envelopes that were in all these file cabinets that we had received and just get the names of the envelopes up on the web. Because then when people are searching for those names, they find the old news project and they see that we have a file on this person, even if there's nothing digitized in it yet. And they're able to contact us and say, I'm looking for information about this person because they found us through just Googling the person's name. And then we were able to find what's in the file, digitize it, work with the person to find the stories and the answers they're looking for.
Then meantime, once you've digitized it, it's up there on the web for the world to explore and share.
That's right.
What have you learned about the people of Washtenaw County as you've kind of paged through decades and decades of history through the paper?
Well, one of the most interesting things about the view of Washtenaw County that from sitting here in 2012
yes.
is our agricultural history. And it's really very easy to forget that it's not that long ago that, you know, a livestock at the state fair was a major news item in Washtenaw County. Mm-hmm. So seeing the agricultural history, how much of the news organization was dedicated to advances in farming technology and things like that, it's really easy to forget that part of our local history. So that's been an interesting part of it. And also, I think, through the Signal of Liberty, sort of the progressive roots of the community going all the way back to the abolitionist movement.
So it wasn't just that Ann Arbor and the University of Michigan was progressive and kind of pushing the envelope through the 60s and the 70s. It goes way back.
Right. Well, and also in the 60s and the 70s, we did a project last year in conjunction with Old News called Freeing John Sinclair about the John mm-hmm. Sinclair rally in the 70s. And we digitized the Ann Arbor Sun, which was the very alternative weekly of the time. And we were also able to digitize the articles from the Ann Arbor News from the same time. So you had the hippie perspective mm-hmm. and the squares perspective, if you will, on
yes.
the same issues. So, and it's great to be able to get many different perspectives on the stories. And, you know, these are all as printed. You know, there's no commentary. It's this is what was printed in the newspaper. And it's there to be found not just by locals, but by the whole world.
I would suspect you are finding a very interesting combination of material that is very, very quaint and very, very outdated, and at the same time, extremely topical and speaks to us in 2012.
Sure. I mean, there's often things like, you know, pictures of two Boy Scouts building their soapbox derby car, you know, and that it would went on to win the next day, that kind of thing. Then at the same time, you see articles from the 20s about people protesting the installation of parking meters and that they're not going to shop at any merchant that has a parking meter out front. And covers for their spare tires on their Continental kit on the back of their car that says, I won't park at a meter. And, you know, so the more things change, the more they stay the same, perhaps. And it's an interesting perspective on the whole community.
I would suspect this would be an effort worthwhile by from other communities. Is this a typical project throughout Michigan, or are you kind of on the forefront?
Well, it's certainly a typical role of libraries to try to make this happen. We were fortunate to be able to negotiate an agreement that allows us to put this content up online. And that tends to be the key, is libraries getting an agreement that allows them to do this, because we don't own the copyright on these materials, mm-hmm. but we have permission from the people who do own the copyright to publish them in this way. And that's really the key.
So for anyone who has any kind of question that dates back to even pre-Civil War era in Washtenaw County about a great-great-grandparent or a news story, all they have to do is contact you at the Ann Arbor Library?
Yeah, they just visit oldnews.aadl.org. And right there, they can see our features and podcasts and photos and all the papers that are there, as well as they can contact us and get into a discussion and let us know what they're looking for.
The Old News Project and Eli Nyberger is with the Ann Arbor District Library, keeping the past alive for everybody. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Still to come on Stateside, Great Lakes water levels have been declining for the past 15 years, and they're getting close to all-time record lows. More on what that could mean for Michigan's environment and our economy, that's coming up in 15 minutes. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It used to be, growing up in Michigan probably meant chances were very good somebody in your circle of family or friends belonged to a labor union. I can still see the Iron Cross symbol of the Firefighters Union on the sticker my dad put on our 59 Chevy Impala station wagon. Friends of mine had dads who were with the UAW or the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. But now in 2012, times are challenging for labor unions. Corporate and civic belt tightening has resulted in lost jobs, givebacks, and lower wages. And just a week ago, Michigan voters rejected Proposal 2, a ballot question that would have enshrined collective bargaining rights in the state constitution. Professor Harley Shaken has closely studied labor and labor unions, and he joins us now from the campus of UC Berkeley. Professor, welcome to Stateside.
It's nice to be here.
Can you help us understand just what do the public opinions show about the way the American public views labor unions?
Well, I think the public opinion polls are relatively favorable. When people are asked, would they join a union, that tends to be much higher than the percentage of workers who are in unions. Clearly, the polls have also gone down, and that's troubling for labor, but not exactly surprising given the kinds of attacks labor has endured in recent decades, to be sure, but in recent years, it's been particularly heavy.
What are the basis of these attacks?
Well, I think what we've seen in Wisconsin, for example, that's sort of the classic case right now with Governor Walker, the notion that unions are the cause of a state's fiscal problem. Mm. We've seen something like that in the private sector as well, where unions have been under very heavy attack, that is a lack of competitiveness being associated with unions. I think on both scores, the argument that's put out against unions is very, very flawed, but that doesn't mean it doesn't resonate.
In fact, that's what I wanted to ask you about. What are your thoughts about those arguments, and tell us how you see them as flawed?
Well, I think when we look at, say, Wisconsin or the other states that are in the midst of such a tough fiscal crisis right now, that's caused by a weak economy. That's caused by a lot of things well beyond the control of the workers for the state. So to blame it on them, on the firefighters, the school teachers, the police, I think really avoids facing the real problems as to how we got there on a state level. And on an industry level, in the private sector, I think it's often much the same thing. The auto industry is the classic case where people associate the UAW and high wages of driving the industry off a cliff. But the industry made billions with high wages when it was producing cars that consumers wanted. Right now, we're seeing a profitable industry once again with relatively high wages. So there's a lot of reasons that cause economic problems. Can unions be one of them? On occasion, sure, but not to the extent that unions have been blamed for it. And I think that's part of the reason why some public attitudes at least have shifted.
Almost, dare one say, sometimes vilified?
Vilified, absolutely. I think that's very much out there. But by the same token, there's a sense of fairness that comes that's often associated with unions. So unions suffered a big defeat, to be sure, when they sought to recall Governor Walker in Wisconsin and failed.
Mm-hmm.
But they had an even bigger victory in Ohio when they did succeed through a referendum of unwinding a state law that would have taken collective bargaining rights away from public sector workers. So unions, while they've been under attack, have also had some pretty impressive successes as well.
Do you think that unions are succeeding, by and large, in their mission of protecting wages as best they can and protecting jobs for their members? Are they able to succeed at that mission?
I think unions continue to succeed at that core mission of protecting the wages and benefits of their members. But it goes, I think, well beyond that historically and even today. And that is workers who are not in a union often benefit by the way, by the games that unions win in unionized sectors of the economy.
Mm.
I think one of the great achievements of post-World War II America was the high, even extraordinary productivity of U.S. industry. And unions served to link that productivity to rising wages for workers who became part of the middle class. The flip side of those high wages was high purchasing power, and that resulted in even more jobs, even more profitable and successful companies. So that's an economic success story we've experienced in the United States that led to a more equal society, that led to a very successful economy.
But now are we
unions?
Go ahead.
So much on the defensive that is eroding, and I think all Americans lose as a result.
And that's what I'm wondering, if that success story from the 20th century. And boy, I'll use my own firefighter father as an example of a public sector employee who provided well for his family. Is that success eroding though in the 21st century? For many reasons, let's talk about world economy and the fact that now it's very easy for companies to send jobs to Mexico, send jobs to China, send jobs elsewhere where they don't have union issues. And how do they hold the ground against that?
Those are the tough challenges that unions face today. I think there's little question about the gains that unions won in the 20th century that all Americans benefited from. And there's as little question about how the attack on unions today, the decline of union membership, has seen those gains erode and in some sectors even be eliminated entirely.
Yes.
Part of it, of course, is globalization. The company can threaten to move a job to a low-wage area. It's going to put a downward pressure on wages. But part of it on jobs that can't be moved, say government jobs, say jobs in the service sector very often, we're still seeing that strong downward pressure, in part because union strength has declined and there's not an effective way that workers have to respond to that.
And that, I would say, I would ask you, does that feel where Michigan is really tied into that, where our struggles as a state are kind of linked with the overall labor union struggles?
Oh, I think Michigan is very linked to the fate of labor unions. In part, it has a high union membership, Overall, it's about 12% in the country. In Michigan, it's over 17%. And so many of the economic gains of Michigan historically have come out of a very strong labor movement. The fact that the UAW was such a powerful force in Michigan gave a middle class that was unusually robust and healthy. And by the same token, all the problems the auto industry has had and the decline of union membership has resulted in pushing back on those gains.
So what do you believe, Professor Harley Shaken, needs to happen within the labor movement to meet the challenges of the future? What do union leaders need to do from their side, working from the inside out?
Well, I would start by saying that the crisis that labor faces today is real. It's one of the most difficult moments in labor's history. But by the same token, I think that challenge can be met. And I think you've got very capable labor leaders out there today that are trying some very innovative new strategies. I think Bob King, for example, from the UAW, Mary Kay Henry from the service employees, and many other labor leaders as well, realize the urgency of the moment and are seeking new approaches, new strategies. One of them is reaching out to a broader community. So it becomes not simply defending union members, but reaching out to environmental groups, human rights groups, community organizations, a broader presence in the society. That's part of it.
Mm. What else? I keep thinking
I think electoral action is part of that. I think, you know, defending union gains at the ballot box, electing representatives that are going to really represent middle-class Americans, really seek to see the middle class expand and thrive. That's part of it. I think it's forging new ways of working with companies. The UAW, again, I think has been in the forefront of this, new collaborative relationships with the industry to see both the competitive industry and its workers sharing in that competitiveness. And that's no longer simply a union story or a union management story. That's the secret to economic growth in a very tough competitive world.
Professor Shaken, what lessons do you think were learned in the auto rescue by both management and the unions?
Oh, I think a key lesson that was learned is that working together is far better for both sides. There are deep differences of opinion, but when they are resolved through a collective bargaining process in a constructive relationship, everyone benefits. So what we're seeing now is not an industry that's out of the woods. The global economy hardly allows that, but a far more competitive industry that's adding jobs in Michigan, to be sure, but throughout the country as well. And to have an industry like auto thriving, a domestic industry, isn't just auto manufacturing. It's a vital part of research and development across the country. So we are a healthier, far healthier economy because of the rescue that took place. And what we're seeing is a new labor management relationship being forged out of it that's successful today in the industry, but shows the value and importance of collective bargaining far beyond those at the bargaining table.
It'll be very interesting to see how this evolves for the labor unions, for our children and our grandchildren.
That's the critical issue right there. Labor has been such a vital part of our history as a country, so essential to what we associate with a certain normal sense as part of our lives.
Yes.
The 40-hour work week, the weekend, a whole range of benefits from Social Security to Medicare that were won with important aid from unions. Sometimes unions were decisive in getting that. So the issue isn't looking back as to what unions have won, but looking towards the future, as you point out, for our children, our grandchildren, about the kind of world we want to see and the value of the interest of working families, of middle-class families, having a strong representative in the society.
Professor Harley Shaken, University of California, Berkeley, thank you so much for sharing your insights with us today on Stateside.
Always nice to be here.
We turn now to what many believe is just about the finest thing about living in Michigan, the Great Lakes. Water levels, though, in Lake Michigan and Lake Huron could hit all-time lows in the next 6 months. That's according to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, and that's something that's tough on recreational boaters and commercial shippers. Ellen Steinman is director of the Annis Water Resources Institute at Grand Valley State University. He has been a leader on water issues here in the Great Lakes for more than a decade. Welcome, Ellen.
Thank you, Cindy. Pleasure to be here.
This isn't something that has just popped up overnight, is it?
No. Well, water levels have been fluctuating ever since the glaciers receded 10,000, 12,000 years ago from the Great Lakes. But since we've been taking measurements, since the 1860s or so, we see fluctuations, and they've gone up and they've gone down, as people can recollect. But the last 15 to 20 years, we've seen a pretty steady decline with a few spikes here and there. But overall, the trend has been pretty clear that it's going down.
And we saw this report from the Army Corps of Engineers about Lakes Michigan and Huron. What about the other lakes?
Well, they vary. They're all down below their long-term means, but some are down more than others. Michigan and Huron, which we treat as one hydrologic unit because they're connected, of course, to the Straits of Mackinac, are lower than all the others. And, you know, that raises the question as to why.
Mm-hmm.
And some people speculate that the dredging that took place in the St. Clair River may be responsible, which is why for the last 5 years, the International Joint Commission has conducted a study in the Upper Great Lakes to look at the water levels and figure out what is responsible. And based on over 40 different studies that were combined as part of that overall study, we found that by far the largest responsible party for the lower water levels was climate. And that was a reflection of less precipitation and more evaporation overall during the last couple of decades.
So that dredging that happened, and that was decades ago, really, wasn't it?
Well, it's happened several times since the early 1900s, a series of different dredging operations by the Army Corps of Engineers. But the one that has garnered the most attention took place in the early 1960s. And yes, they are responsible for some of the decline, but percentage-wise, it's a relatively small amount.
So what does it mean, in your view, to Michigan to have these Great Lakes approaching historic lows? I suspect there's almost a dual impact, ecological and economic.
Well, it's a dual impact with respect to the ecology and economics, absolutely. But what's even more interesting is that depending upon the sector that you talk to, you're going to find some people who find this disastrous, and you're going to find some people who actually find it beneficial. For example, the people who live along the west side of the state of Michigan, the east shore of Lake Michigan, like the lower water levels. Their homes that were at risk when the water levels were last very high in 1986 now find that their property is quite stable, and they're pleased with the lower water levels. But on the other hand, the commercial shippers, which have to light load and therefore take a huge economic hit with lower water levels, are certainly put at a disadvantage. And the coastal wetlands, which are probably the most critical habitat that we have here for fish and wildlife, are also going to be hit hard.
Ellen, is there anything that can be done about these shrinking water levels, let's say at a policy level or a lifestyle level?
On both, Cynthia. Really, if you want to talk about policy, one of the aspects of that Upper Great Lakes study done by the International Joint Commission was looking at possible opportunities to hold water back in the St. Clair River right at the mouth of Lake Huron. And we evaluated a number of different engineering solutions, including these large inflatable bladders that would hold the water back, different types of swing gates and weirs to hold water back in particular places. But it's problematic. They're very, very expensive. There would be huge permitting issues because of navigation and also some of the very critical lake sturgeon spawning habitat in the Great Lakes happens to take place in these portions of the St. Clair River. So when you combine the expense, when you combine the fact that you've got multiple jurisdictions involved, including two different nations, it becomes very, very complicated. On an individual basis, we all can take responsibility for this. One of the problems we face here, it's an ironic one, it's paradoxical actually, is that because we have so much water around us, even with water levels declining, we tend to be complacent as opposed to the people who, you know, live in the arid Southwest who really value water because it's so rare. Not to say we don't value it here, but we can become complacent and not use it as efficiently as we should. So conserving water, perhaps sprinkling less often, perhaps not growing turf grass, taking xeriscaping into account are all ways we can conserve water throughout all our everyday personal habits. And we've got to do that. I think it makes sense in the future, regardless of where we live, to be good stewards of our environment.
I'm sure this will not be the last time we talk with you, Alan, about our Great Lakes as we keep an eye on those shrinking levels. Alan Steinman, thanks for talking with us today.
Pleasure, Cynthia.
Alan Steinman is director of the Annis Water Resources Institute at Grand Valley State University. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Mark Brush is our engineer today. Contributors are Allie Billings, Ellen Cortezoa, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program's a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening, and let's talk again tomorrow at 3:00.